to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael is an internationally known, highly respected political scientist. He's an award-winning author and lecturer. He's written many books. They include Democracy for the Few. I think it's in its 9th edition, or maybe by now it's in its 10th or 11th edition. I'll let Michael update me on that. Also, Super Patriotism, Inventing Reality. I could go on and on and on. We want to discuss major issues that Michael is focusing on. And I must say, Michael, I began reading your books long ago. They taught me so much. And what I do now, I owe a great deal to what you taught me and how you inspired me to get into what I'm doing. I didn't plan to be doing what I'm doing, Michael. It just happened. But I owe you a great debt of gratitude.
Oh, well, thank you.
I've been writing about so much, the major issues, world and national. I mentioned a few of them in my emails to you. What's on your mind, mostly? I mean, there's so much. Say what's on your mind. There is so much going on. We've got a neoliberal war against ordinary Americans at home. We've got imperial wars abroad. We've got a major Venezuelan election tomorrow. Want to jump in on any of those?
Well, you said it all right there. That covers it. By the way, I have a more recent book called The Face of Imperialism, where I deal with this U.S. power taking over the entire world. And I raise the question, why do we need this world order or this empire? My view is that this empire that we've built of 750 military bases all around the world, of armed forces that, on every continent, in scores and scores of nations, U.S. troops are present, fighting 3, 4, 5 wars at one time or another. Military actions, killings of all sorts, drones destroying villages, killing people who don't even know where the United States is, and the like. All of this head by a president who just sucks up to reactionaries at every opportunity he can, who talks about President Reagan as a transformative president. I'm speaking, of course, about Obama, the Obama. I just wrote a piece which I posted about 10 minutes ago, Steve, called Requiem for a Dominatrix, and it's an obit about Margaret Thatcher and sundry other characters.
Michael, yeah, I look forward to reading that. I wrote my own article on Thatcher, and I whacked her very hard.
You got to look forward to reading the statement that President Obama wrote after she died and talked about her as a champion of liberty and freedom, and how she stood shoulder to shoulder with Ronald Reagan facing the challenges of the world with incredible courage and iron will. It's really nauseating, and you think, well, this is the guy, of course, who is betraying us on Social Security. Now that he got reelected, Social Security is on the table. Disability is on the table. You know, I have a very close friend who suffers a serious disability. She's trying to live on $900 a month. She can't. She gets help from some of us, you know. But there are people who are living in such hardship and such desperation in this country, and this guy who's president can only suck up to the reactionaries and such, and write laudatory, cloying, adulatory statements about these people, about Thatcher and Reagan and such. So where's the democracy? Where's the anti-imperialism? What we have to first understand is why the U.S. does these things. It's not power for power's sake. It's not just overweening pride. It's not just misguided well intentions. There are no well intentions. They know exactly what they're doing. They're every bit as smart as you. When you think your enemies who are running the world and ruining the world and for their own benefit and their own accumulation of wealth, if you think they're just confused and they just aren't as smart as you, then you're pretty stupid. That's what I would say to people who are constantly writing books about how U.S. foreign policy must be dealt out by a bunch of nitwits, you know, who just can't seem to stay out of wars and who get themselves into all sorts of fixes and complications.
Michael, it's very true, and of course still most people follow the corporate media, the ones I call the scoundrel media. They get their news on television for the most part. Thankfully, I think the ratings are beginning to go down. Maybe incrementally people are wising up that simply is not the way to find out what's going on. These people lie to you systematically. That's their job. I wrote an article several years ago. It had a longer title, but in it I referred to the media as paid liars. Imagine lying for a living and getting paid for it. Anybody who tells the truth on what matters most, you can't get a job in the major media. I once emailed the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and I offered to be a free contributor, to contribute free articles to both publications. Well, needless to say, Michael, I never heard from either one of them.
You gave them your background, your experience with media, of course, and news.
No. I wonder if they knew anything about me at that time. I was a lot newer at what I'm doing than I am now. I think the New York Times knows me well. I bash them constantly. I've got them in a new article that I'll put out tomorrow that I call creating a North Korean threat. And I wrote another article on North Korea that I bash the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, the usual suspects, Michael.
Oh, you could read them all, and Fox, of course, and NBC, CNN, and such. They all suffer from amnesia. They all start in the middle or the end of the story and never contextualize the story. They never mention that North Korea faces every year these most threatening military maneuvers of planes, attacks, and troops all right around their waters and their borders carried out by the U.S. and South Korea. There's never any mention that, North Korea for 60 years has been trying to get a peace treaty signed with the U.S., and the U.S. has completely refused. That North Korea has even called for reunification, but with federated systems. I don't know how that would really work, but in any case, they're painted as these suicidal, warmongers and crazed threats hurling, and when in fact what you see is not murderous aggression by the North Koreans, but really a certain element of desperation, it seems.
Yeah, hello. I think that's very true.
Was my voice getting through, Stephen?
Oh, yeah. I hear
something
you
clicking here at this end.
Oh, I hear you loud and clear. I don't hear clicking. That's odd.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes I'll hear something you won't hear or another guest
good.
Won't hear.
That means
you hear something that I don't hear. But you're coming through loud and clear to me. And I think if there was an audio problem, my studio would alert me, and then I could alert you like we're on a bad line so we could reconnect on a good line. But I think everything's coming through fine.
Just want to keep your listeners happy, that's all.
Oh, indeed. Well, with you on, I'm sure they're happy.
Oh, right. Okay. Thank
Mike,
you.
Mike, I absolutely agree. I'll just echo what you're saying. Since the latest saber rattling on the part of Washington and their allies began a few weeks ago or so, I think I've written four articles on North Korea. I lose count, but I've got another one going out tomorrow about creating a North Korean threat. But that's exactly right. They never wanted the Korean War in June 1950. It was Harry Truman's war. There were multiple incursions north of the border because Truman ordered them, and when North Korea finally responded enough, saying, we're not going to take any more of this, it became North Korea's war, and we had an uneasy... I was in college then. I was scared. It was a draft, Michael.
I was scared like other kids. I was a freshman, and I was still in high school when it began, but before it ended, I was a freshman and then a sophomore, a freshman in 1952, a sophomore in 1953, and we had to be sure that we did nothing to not keep our grades up, otherwise we could be drafted. So we didn't want any part of that war, and it was a terrible war. The carnage was just appalling. North Korea was leveled to rubble, and the North Koreans have long memories. I'm sure they teach the kids in school that, and they don't have to make it up. It's true what happened, and they don't want another war.
Yes, that's quite right. And what the North Koreans do know is that they're on a short list. They're on a hit list that George, an American president, George W. Bush, put them on the list and said it is an axis of evil. It's composed of three countries, and that's Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And the North Koreans have seen what happened to Iraq. It has been ruined. More than half of its population has been killed or displaced or injured or driven into exile, or communities have been destroyed. The whole infrastructure of Iraq has been destroyed. They've seen what's happened to Iraq. They see what's happening with Iran, with the sanctions and the encirclement. And now the very same charges that were made against Iraq, they're building a secret nuclear weapon of mass destruction and such. Now the very same lines are being used with Iran to justify a, quote, defensive war, when in fact it's a war of aggression. Well, the North Koreans looked around and they said, well, the only countries the U.S. dare not attack are those that have nuclear weapons, so we're going to start acting like we're a nuclear power. And they may have something on a rocket that might be able to reach beyond a limited sphere, but it's hardly a major threat. But it's a threat that's being created by the U.S. and then it's used to justify attacking the country.
Indeed, Michael. I'm speaking with Michael Parenti. Michael really understands these issues very well, and in his books he's addressed issues of war and peace, imperialism. You know, is the book that you mentioned, Michael, is that just out, or is it one that's been out in recent months?
No, The Face of Imperialism came out last year.
Came out last year.
I'm sorry, yeah. I do have a new book coming out in a few months, in a couple of months, I think, and it's a memoir of my childhood, actually. But with a lot of social commentary and stuff worked into. It's called Waiting for Yesterday, Pages from a Street Kid's Life. I was raised in a very poor neighborhood. Our family was poor, Italian American working class, and in New York, in Italian Harlem, it was called, or East Harlem, and the book is about that: the family, the street, the church, the school. Some of the school stories are right out of Dickens, for God's sake, the way we were treated as kids, you know.
But, bad, huh?
Yeah, not good. Yeah, you know.
Well, I grew up in inner city Boston. I don't think I'll write a book about it, inner city Boston. But I must say that my family was lower middle income. The neighborhood was mixed, but I never remember any trouble. I have wonderful memories of the schools I went to. None of them exist anymore, Michael, as you can imagine. The war waged on public education, and these schools came down long, long ago. But I had good teachers. They taught. We had classroom decorum. On the street, there were scraps every now and then, but kids get into scraps. I never remember anything serious.
Yeah, no, the same with me. We had a gang, but we would never even think of carrying weapons or anything like that, and then never even think of drugs. It was never a question of that kind of stuff. It was just a lot of fist fights now and then, you know. But I agree. And I hailed the public libraries. I remember I have a little box insert in one of the pages about how the library was kind of an oasis for me. Every so often when I got tired of the street, or the handball court or the pool room, I would I would go to the library, and it was like, as I say, a nurturance. I could read, I could open up windows into other worlds, and that was. Yeah, there were some good things. For one way or another, we survived. We had a lot of intelligent kids too, to countervail the stereotype of the dumb Italian kid. You know, the Fonz who just stands there and talks in D's and dumbs and all that sort of stuff. It was great fun writing that book, and people who read the pre-publication have enjoyed it. So anyway, I just wanted to give it a plug, Stephen.
Oh, Michael, when it's out, you've got to come back on the program. We'll spend the whole program talking about it.
Well, I don't know if you want to really do that, but
well, sure. we can integrate it with social and political issues, and comparing the world that you and I grew up in. I think we're both of the same generation. We both grew up in a world.
What's your ethnic background, Steve?
I'm Jewish.
Uh huh. So there were
born in this country. My family from Eastern Europe.
Right, and where in Boston was that?
I grew up in Roxbury.
Roxbury. Yeah. That, I thought of it by the time I heard of Roxbury, it was pretty much a black neighborhood.
Yeah, it was mixed when I grew up, but all of the kids just got along fine with each other, and the only competition was in the sports that we played, and as we kids would choose up sides. We didn't care if a kid was white, black, or anything else. We just cared how well he could play.
How was your game, Stephen? I won't put you on the spot. I won't put you on the spot. You don't have to tell us.
Oh, well, let's put it this way. I enjoy playing those games very much. I'm a little guy, but I liked, it was easy for me playing something like stickball, but even touch football, basketball, the highest I could ever jump, I couldn't even touch the bottom of the net, let alone anything more than that. I don't think the word dunk existed back in those days.
What I noticed today is that children have disappeared. I mean, I don't see them playing in the streets. And here, mine's a residential street, and one day there were kids on the street playing stickball. I was rubbing my eyes, thought I had gone into a, fell into a time warp or something. Well, it was just one day. I don't know. A bunch of kids were around. But generally, there are no children around. You know, they're busy with their little iPods or iPads and TVs and games and the like. And when they do get into sports, it's all adult organized too. You know, so you got soccer moms and baseball moms and hockey moms and all that stuff.
Well, none of that existed in the old days.
Yeah, nothing. But we did have a childhood culture. We had a culture with Ringolivio and hide and seek and all sorts of kids' games and things like that. Now that I think about it, you know, it wasn't the worst of times. If I had been born much later, I would have ended up being shot up with Ritalin and you know, curbed in one way or another, or I don't even want to think about it. But anyway, getting back to the crises of this day, the hypocrisies and that are pursued by President Obama, in which he pretends to be humanitarian when in fact he's fighting these bloody wars, and he pretends to be protecting the security of the American people and peace-loving people everywhere. We have this new concept of humanitarian wars. You know, when did wars become humanitarian? And what's left unstated is the real motives of these wars, which is to monopolize the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of the world, moving into countries, Central Asia, Middle East, Africa now, always been in Latin America, having a little rough time in Latin America, but still still there, excuse me, fighting off one of those innumerable colds.
Oh, it can get nippy where you are, Michael.
Yeah, and so this is what we're facing. Our treasure, our money, upwards of $1 trillion a year, go toward paying for these wars and for this imperialism. The empire feeds off the republic. And as the empire grows bigger and richer and more powerful in its striking force, in its reach, in its bases, to make the world safe for the IMF, the World Bank, and for multinational corporations, it does all that. The domestic front gets poorer and poorer. We're turning into a third world country, and that means a country where a few people continue to accumulate immense wealth, while the great mass of people, the other 99%, are having a tough time of it, are having an increasingly difficult time of it.
Well, they sure are. And literally, there is a war. There is a war going on at home. We've got this terrible neoliberal war. It really is outrageous. It began,
right.
It began with Margaret Thatcher. She predated Reagan by a year or two, and she began it. And then the two of them waged war on social benefits, and they began declining. But in the new millennium, Michael, there's really been a war, a neoliberal war. It's come hard. It's come down hard on ordinary people. People just can't afford this, and now they're going after Medicare and Social Security full bore.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And and Obama is a reactionary. He's rolling back Social Security. He's talking about we need to do this for the deficit. But Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit. It's a self-financing system. It returns billions of dollars in surplus, money which then goes into the regular budget and is used to pay the regular, but the Social Security should have about a $3 trillion surplus by now, and it does have it, just the Treasury bonds, you know, just printed up, and they're sitting there somewhere, but it doesn't mean, it's not real wealth, it's just paper, they turn it into paper wealth, but it's real wealth when it's taken from our salaries and such. So this whole thing that he's doing now, to deprive us of cost of living coverage, is just a way of putting the squeeze on Social Security, and he'll be raising the age at which people can retire. That's another thing, you know. If you've had a nice comfy white collar job, like say a college professor, I mean, then you might want to stay on after 65 and all, you know, to keep these captive kids in the classroom listening to your holding forth. But a lot of people who do physical labor, 65 is a tough age to reach, you know. If you've been lifting garbage cans and garbage trucks for years, your back starts going, your shoulder starts going. I have a friend who's a contractor. And I mean, he runs the company, but he does a lot of the physical labor himself. He's just late 50s, and he's feeling it terribly. So people have a hard time, and it's people who don't do physical labor who are making the rules and imposing the suppositions on people who do physical labor. So. I mean, it's Medicare being jerked around. Medicare is a great blessing and help. It's helped me out two times, but it's totally inadequate in terms of the way the private medical system operates. It's a horrible system, a system that is designed for profit accumulation, not for giving health and help to people who are in need, and that is criminal, and that, yet this is what we're facing. Healthcare should be socialized, because socialism works better in certain things. It works better for healthcare. It works better for education, it works better for transportation. Just look at the social democracies in Europe where these things are publicly run. They're not run for profit, they're run for public needs, and yet they cost less, and they're run more efficiently and safely and workably. A lot of that is getting rolled back in Europe, too. What they're doing is they're using the malperformance of capitalism as an excuse to undermine social democracy and get us back to free market capitalism, make it worse and worse and worse and more expensive. It works better and better for fewer and fewer people at our expense.
Yeah, it really is true, Michael. And on the Medicare issue, we have a gatekeeper and a middleman called insurance companies. Most of them, well, a lot of them are
right.
big. Some of them are smaller. Most people know about Blue Cross. And, of course, you and I on Medicare, Medicare is inadequate, as you said. You get Part A and Part B, but they simply don't cover the cost. So in my case, I need a Medicare supplement. I have supplemental insurance, and it's not cheap. And what Washington does is they up the cost of Part B. Obama wants to put a cost on Part A, means testing it. He wants to put a COLA, cost of living allowance, on Social Security. These are federal contractual obligations. And I've written about both programs. Medicaid is a welfare program for people who can't afford medical care. But Social Security and medical care, everybody who works pays for these. Payroll taxes.
Mm-hmm.
They're insurance
right.
premiums. That's what they are. They're no different than paying insurance premiums on a life insurance policy. As bad as those insurers are, Michael, they wouldn't dare welch on a policy. They might try to wiggle out of whatever they can, but they couldn't welch on it. You could sue them and win, but you'll never sue the federal government and win, and that's what they're doing. They're whittling down the benefits. They'll do it incrementally over time, and I think eventually the end game is either privatize the system, which means it's death knell, or simply end it altogether.
Yes, and this undoing is being led by a president for whom all these poor working people voted for and saw him as an alternative to the Mitt Romney rich boys. But he's really not much different, really not much different. A few little scraps here or there maybe, but very little.
Oh, I think he is terrible, absolutely terrible, Michael. I wrote about him in 2000. I've written so many articles about him, but the first one I wrote was in 2008 during the campaign. I went back and I wrote about his voting record in the U.S. Senate and what he did in Chicago and in the Illinois Senate. I mean, his record was, especially the U.S. Senate, his voting record was appalling. If you just took off the name Obama and saw the things that he supported, he was as Republican as most Republicans, and in some ways, he was more Republican. I said, people are going to be very disappointed if this guy gets elected, and he looked like a sure thing because Bush left office with a rock-bottom approval rating, and I think McCain-Palin, I think that was a ticket picked to lose, not win, and Obama, of course, won an overwhelming victory, and I'm in Chicago, Michael. I still remember the night in November. I didn't go down, but Chicago has a big park downtown, Grand Park. It was like New Year's Eve. I wasn't there, but I read about it the next day, and then I wrote about what happened. I mean, people went absolutely wild that this guy was elected. They had no idea what was coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he struck me from day one on the Oprah show when she said, "What have you thought of running for president?" And he's looking, and he just looked like a complete phony to me. I think he is too. I don't have to think it. I'd love to see those articles. I mean, do you send them? Am I on your mailing list?
Well, I'll send you that 2000. I've written so many about Obama. I can't imagine sending them all. I think there have been dozens, Michael. But I'll send you the one I wrote in 2008 because it had a lot of detail on his Senate voting record.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. That would be great. Thank you.
As soon as we get off here, I'll email it to you.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's see. What other grievance do we have?
Signs
of hope? Is the Occupy movement still in existence? It's been suppressed, first ignored and battered by the media and misrepresented, and then attacked by the police and literally battered then, not just verbally. Repressive forces, whenever there are a successful assembly of democratic forces, they're repressed. And that seems to be happening more regularly. The police are looking better equipped than ever. Each cop has about $5,000-$7,000 worth of equipment on him, tasers and percussion grenades and a suit of armor and helmets and guns and one thing or another. And they march in military formation. Oh, they're so proud when they do that little two-step together, you know, shoulder to shoulder with their clubs out. They're really fearless when fighting against young, unarmed people who are in the streets there. And that comes down on people. People who remarkably, in the face of all of this propaganda, all the mainstream media, all of the distortions, all the lack of hearing the things that one can hear only on programs like yours and a few other people, despite all that, you had people saying what it was. It was the fight between over the great divide, the 1% versus the 99%, that 1% at the very top. It's really even less than 1%. 1% would be about 3 million. It's probably a couple of hundred thousand people compose the super rich, you know. The Walton family, there's only seven of them, and they own all $90 billion worth of wealth from Walmart. And how did the Waltons do it? There was no new technology or new invention that, I mean, you know, give Bill Gates at least that much credit. The Waltons did it by simply squeezing the surplus value out of people who they worked, their employees.
Michael Hadley, that music means we need to take a very, very brief break. Let's do that. Hold your thought, and we'll come right back.
Right.
Welcome back. Talking with Michael Parenti. Michael, let me let you pick up where you left off, and maybe when you finish with that topic, there's a big, big day in Venezuela tomorrow. Venezuelans will vote, and I'm sure you'll be paying attention to that. But let me let you continue with what you were discussing.
What were we discussing? I'm trying to remember now. Stephen, help me.
Oh, my goodness. I lost my train of thought.
Well,
we were talking about stuff going on at home. Obama's
Medicaid,
policies.
Yeah, and it's amazing how the system can produce a choice that isn't a choice, where both candidates really, although different in veneer, one is bad and the other is worse. And therefore, there's your... That's your choice, which is, you know, the lesser of two evils, as they say. It's very real. It's very true. people really get caught up on style and appearances and don't look at the substance of the issues. I did mention that the hopeful development was the Occupy movement that came from nowhere. No one predicted it. Nobody anticipated it. And there were these tens of thousands of people who were talking about the inequities that are going on and the growing inequality in America. the breakdown of public services, the obscene increase of wealth. And I was talking about the Walton family, the richest group of modern functional active capitalists, super rich. There are those like Mellons and Morgans and Rothschilds and Rockefellers and such who are, you know, their money is just all in there. They're not really out dealing in directly as employers anymore. But the Waltons are. They run and they own Walmart. And the way they've accumulated their immense wealth is by extracting value from the work that people are doing, paying them much less than the value that they produce. That's how they just did it. But getting goods from sweatshops all over the world, paying really low sums for the work that's produces these goods, done by people who are paid starvation wages, and then having paying workers in America at the Walmart stores and all over the world, paying them hardly subsistent wages. Now, you and I and your listeners deserve some credit for the Walton family's immense fortune, because we pay taxes, as we're going to be paying just this Monday, April 15th. We pay it to the federal government, and the federal government gives green stamps to Walmart workers, many of whom can't make it. Their wages, the minimum wage. How do you live on $80 a day, which isn't even your take home? You probably take home more like 60 of that. So here's how you live on it. You get food stamps from the federal government. So Walmart is actually, the Walton family is being subsidized by the federal government and us U.S. taxpayers, because they can't give their workers a living wage. And so we have to supplement that. I want a country, I'm not against food stamps when they're desperately needed for people, but I'd like a country where working people should be making enough to support themselves. But if you did that, then the Walmart family would be worth, say, oh, I don't know, only $70 billion instead of $90 billion or something like that, and they're not going to want to do that. So this is what we've got in our country. The American dream has been lost now for all those people who thought, and that wasn't just accidentally. There was a concerted effort made by the super rich to roll back the developing social democracy that existed in America. They even said it. I've got quotes by them. They were starting this back during the Jimmy Carter days of saying, it's just getting out of hand. The wages are staying firm. We can't drop these wages. Workers are looking for the paid vacations. They want to keep seniority. They get a job and expect to have a career out of this job as a bus driver or this or that for the rest of their lives. We don't want that, you know. So this is what we're facing now. We're facing a world where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting really plundered. And the harder they can make you work, the more ready you'll work for less and less. I mean, recessions are not a bad thing. This recession that happened, as you see, the rich have been doing very, very well in it. The stock market has reached record heights. Finance capital is rolling it in. So recessions are really quite good, but one of the things they do is they allow big corporations to swallow up smaller companies and corporations for bargain prices, and even to swallow up other big companies. It's not just the big fish eating the small fish. They eat other big fish. I mean, we see these concentration of capital that's immense. The other thing it does is it disciplines the worker, both collectively and individually. You have workers, young people who are signing up for jobs after college that, you know, become baristas and work making lattes for other people. And this becomes the only work available, regardless of whatever training you've got. If you're lucky, if you can even get that kind of a job. So this is what people are facing. And labor unions are tame during recessions, and labor unions go into decline, and they often are broken. more and more is imported from overseas labor. What you had in the last 20 years or so is a growth of the world labor market. An additional 3 or 4 or 5 billion workers now arriving on the world capitalist scene. And they're from Eastern Europe, they're from the former Soviet Union, they're from China, India, Africa. People now who are part of the world workforce, that also depresses wages when you've got 10 people lining up for a job that used to have one or two looking for it. So they talk about, well, the free market would make everything well if we only gave it a chance. We never really tried it. That's the ideologue, free market ideologues. They like to walk around, like the anarchists do the same thing. It's a system that's never really been tried. It actually has been. The free market has been tried, and it's been the rule for years. And in 1900, we had a free market here in America, and it was a land of underemployment. It was a land of hunger. It was a land of typhoid and tuberculosis and all sorts of the diseases of poverty. Families crowded into hovels, doubled and tripled up, almost like the tenement houses of ancient Rome. And this is the America, it seems, that the ruling class wants to move back to further and further.
It's so true, Michael. I'm speaking with Michael Parenti. Michael, your points are so well taken. We've got
I wish they were better given. I'm stumbling along here. I hope you follow what I'm saying.
No, well, I absolutely follow them, and my listeners do as well. They're very important because this is exactly what's happening. We're really turning America, as you say, into a third world country. We're most of the way along with toward tyranny, police state laws, especially post 9/11. Obama added more to the ones that Bush got enacted, and militarism writ large, multiple global wars. I'm certain that more are planned. There's no end to this stuff. And the situation of Venezuela is so different. I wanted your comments on Bolivarianism and Chavismo, some people call it. Chavez died on March 5th. Nicolas Maduro was his foreign minister, a former National Assembly speaker, a union leader. He became acting vice president. He became acting president. And finally, a very short campaign that ended on Friday. Friday, Michael, there were final rallies held, and I saw photos from Caracas, the main central area of Caracas. 7 avenues were absolutely wall-to-wall with humanity, a sea of red, and estimates, and I believe them, somewhere between 2 and 3 million people turned out to hear Maduro. I guess they must have set up loudspeakers around the area so people could hear him, and that was the final rally, and most people support him. They support the social changes that Chavez gave and institutionalized over 14 years. It's such a completely different situation than what exists in America. Several years ago, I wrote an article. I forget I think the title was something like Venezuela and America, Constitutional Worlds Apart. The benefits that ordinary Venezuelans get, they're mandated in the Constitution. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution about social benefits except the nebulous general welfare clause that's absolutely meaningless.
That's absolutely right. You're right. The democracy we have is purely a procedural one, and it's very severely curbed by all sorts of checks and balances, so-called checks and imbalances, I would call them, supermajority votes that are needed and vetoes and the like, and divisions. And there's not a word about economic democracy. We got some of that with the New Deal, where the rhetoric used by Roosevelt and some of the policies he pursued, a lot of the policies he pursued were designed to, for all the shortcomings of the New Deal, they were designed to better the lives of people, to create a greater economic democracy, and we have very little of that today. Very little.
Boy, we have little, and it is being very, very seriously eroded, as you know, Michael. I literally think, I wrote one article I called, I read so many, I forget the titles, but it was basically Obama's war on social America. He wants to destroy social America, and he's literally in cahoots with Republicans, and I fear that most Democrats feel the same way. They say one thing, and they do another, and the backroom deals are cut, and you can see it happening. And straight away after Obama was elected, Michael, he gave an interview to the Washington Post, and he called Medicare a major problem. I quoted him verbatim that we had a do something about Medicare and cut it down. We simply can't afford it. Well, we can afford it if we do it right. Just minor adjustments.
It's one of the few things that are affordable. I mean, that's just a lie, a blatant lie. And his own, I'm sorry, got interrupted you. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean Medicare is affordable. I was just interjecting. Go on with what you were saying, Stephen.
Well, there is a war going on. Democrats and Republicans are complicit. Obama is leading it, and the rhetoric that you get in the mainstream, where you know you read the headlines and the stories, and you watch TV news, and it's Obama disagreeing with the Republicans. Oh, that's nonsense. They've basically agreed on what they want to do. They're targeting the big ticket social items, Medicare and Social Security. They're going to hit Medicaid. They want people who need food stamps so they can feed their families. They want those cut down. And there's been so much done to harm ordinary people in Obama's first term. And I've written about them in previous articles. I mean, important programs that people rely on, they've been chipped away at. And it's going to continue in Obama's second term. But now they really want to wage war on Social Security and Medicare. And they'll do it incrementally so people don't even realize what's going on. And they'll do it by raising the cost, Michael, as they do for us. They keep the programs, and they make us pay more for them. We shouldn't have to pay anything for these things. We've already paid for them in our payroll taxes, but that's never discussed in the mainstream.
That's quite right, how we are exploited, not only as workers, but as taxpayers, tremendous, tremendous amounts. Some of the best investments that corporate America makes are in terms of taxes. I mean, you know, in terms of public spending, I mean, they can pay out a few 10,000 here, 20,000 there, 50,000, 100,000 even in lobbying fees and suites and election campaigns and such. And what they get back in return is millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts and access to natural resources that are valued at hundreds of millions of dollars. So, as Kevin Bacon said, that's the biggest the best investments you can make is buying this sort of thing, is exploiting taxpayers as well as workers.
What's really happening, Michael?
So I voted for Jill Stein. Wasn't that her name, Jill Stein?
Oh, Jill Stein, the Green Party.
Yeah, I thought she was pretty good. I listened to her, and I did want my vote to count somewhere along the way, and it doesn't. I mean, you literally, when you vote for a third party, the major media do not count the vote. They never report the several million people who vote for third-party candidates. Not they go unmentioned, usually, unless it's a Ross Perot who gets a big splash and gets attention from the major media and is suddenly invited to join in on the debates. It's amazing how when they finally do that, they won't let Ralph Nader debate with the major candidates when he was running, but they let Ross Perot do that.
That was the last time they did it, Michael. 1992, and he won. What did he win? About 20% of the vote.
I don't think it was that high, but it was a good bit. So,
they decided it wasn't a good idea to have an independent candidate debating with the Republicans and Democrats. So 1992 was the last time it happened, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, and he was not somebody to admire or put your faith in anyway. He was kind of off, if you will, and was really a conservative cloaked as a defiant, radical of some sort, and he wasn't that. No, the goal is to really impoverish us. And you could say, but why would they want to do that? They would want us to be prosperous and have a lot of income, because then we will buy all the goods and services that they produce and they'll make more profit. It really doesn't work that way. They don't really want a population that has a high sense of entitlement, that has a high level of expectation. They don't want a population that's literate and can organize itself and challenge and question what's being done to their world, to their labor, their taxes, their money, their natural resources. They don't want that. They want people who stay in line and who work hard and long. And see, the hungrier you are, the more I can limit your life chances, the more willing you will be to work for less and less. I mean, why is it in Indonesia people line up for jobs that pay 12 cents an hour? 12 cents an hour. And why won't Americans line up for jobs that pay 12 cents an hour? Well, you couldn't live on a job like that. But is it because we're so proud and all that? No, it's because we've reached a level of historical struggle where the working class does do better than, say, in Indonesia. But their goal is to get us back to a country like Indonesia, to get us back to a third world country where public services don't even exist. I mean, the bus systems in Indonesia are terrible. The buses break down. There are bus plunges every 3 or 4 weeks. A bus goes over the side because the roads are broken up and the like. People are killed. There's no health programs for the poor. If you don't have money, if you can't pay the doctor right there in the waiting room, you don't get help. You just die. And that's what happens. People just die. They're dispensable. But meanwhile, to be very rich in Indonesia is marvelous. I mean, you live in a big mansion. You've got a gated, you've got guards who stand with guns and you can hire 5 or 6 or 7 of them. They're non-productive workers. They're not producing value that's for communal benefit of everybody. They're just there to protect the rich. This is the way you live. You've got an army of servants who take care of you, everything you need. To be rich in Indonesia is wonderful. It's just, life is just terrific. They love it. But for the other 99%, it's really very, very difficult. And their goal, and we had it, we were Indonesia back in 1900 and 1880 or whatever. There were fights there were some gains made with unions and strikes and organizing. The workday went from 14 hours to 12 hours. wages went up a little bit, you know, but not really by much. And that's why capitalism was constantly in a state of crisis. Capitalism is a system in which crises runs panics in the market. These are regular things. These are things that go on all the time. They want to be in a state of crisis and emergency and alarm, keeping people in a state of desperation. And
Michael and Deesa, let me just alert you. We have about a minute left. I say that so you can get in the most important thoughts you want to get across to listeners before the program ends.
The thought is we need a system which is operating for the service and well-being and needs of the people, that can be self-financing, that's not run for profits, but that's run to function. For instance, a transportation system where there's no private profit, private wealth, where the railroads are not run and owned by rich plutocrats whose concern is to run these railroads into the ground so that they can make more and more and quicker profits. But a railroad system that's run very well, that's financed by the passengers, by the taxpayers, who get back in return a good service. So services, human needs are fulfilled, the jobs are created, people pay taxes, all of this done without anybody getting rich on profits.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. We are plumb out of time, and I've got to go. But I could put it in your words and say we need an America with democracy for everybody, not democracy for the few. And we sure don't have it. We've never had it. And it gets worse and worse all the time. Michael, I look forward to getting you back, whether it's on your forthcoming book, whatever it's on. You're a marvelous guest. I hope you will come back.
Okay, well, thank you, Stephen. I will, certainly.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm sorry I went rambling on.
Oh, you know, you weren't rambling. You were teaching us, and we all need to get the wisdom that you can give to everybody. Great thanks, Michael.
Well, my best wishes to you and the work you're doing, Stephen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Join us again tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.